Welcome to the Eco News Report, your weekly environmental news show. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, and I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Hey, Tom.
Jen Colt of Humboldt Bay Keeper.
Hello.
And Scott Greeson of Friends of the Old River. All right, so on this week's show, we're going to break down the children's crusade to stop our planet from frying, and then Scott has some weird, irreverent news about walruses or something that he wants to share with all of us. Cool, let's jump in. I don't know about y'all, but my Facebook has just been blown apart by this little blonde girl from some Nordic country. Yeah, so the climate protests. We had ours in Arcata last Friday. All right, well, I was there. It was nice. We had students walk out from Arcata High School. Yeah. Kids came down from HSU. We all met on the plaza together. So I thought it was a nice event. No one could hear what the speakers were saying, and people would drive by and rev their diesel trucks. And, you know, it's like any protest in Humboldt County. But this was a part of a larger thing. And it was a larger thing that Greta Thunberg, she started with her weekly school protests. And so this is perhaps a good episode to talk about her work, and then also just the great large number of student, young person-driven activism around climate change. Did anyone watch her UN speech?
Yes.
I did.
Tell me about it.
It was one of those speeches that I think that we'll look back on like so many landmark speeches in the past that people always go back to. Remember when Martin Luther King said this or so-and-so said that? I think this was that kind of speech. It was simple, but very direct and just cut right through all the BS.
So my favorite part was when she lectures world leaders. And I thought that that was the soundbite of the moment, was the how dare you. And she has the point. And her broader point is that it's our generation that's going to face the consequences. And you guys are screwing it all up.
Well, and continuing to just focus on false promises of economic growth and profit and, you know, just what drives American capitalism generally.
Well, in the world, I mean, the whole world is expecting this to be magically solved without actually doing anything to solve it. The current economic systems that the world is operating under has failed to address this. It's not going to be able to address it. And these kids are fed up. They don't see a future.
A lot of people will probably think, oh, people are not dying. What is she talking about? But if you look to the lawsuit that was filed on Monday, yeah, a bunch of young people from all over the world filed a lawsuit pointing to all the people who have died and are dying from extreme weather events that are just multiplying. The news every day is it was 90 degrees in Alaska on 4th of July. That sort of thing just compounding.
Take a look at Guatemala. The Trump administration cuts aid to Guatemala right when they need it, when they're suffering in an environmental disaster, they're running out of water, their crops are failing, and we're not giving them any aid. So of course people are fleeing Guatemala and coming here. And then we're putting them in cages when they get here.
And we're seeing our own climate refugees here in Humboldt County, where folks coming over, yeah, from the Carr Fire or from any number of large destructive fires in the last couple of years are now moving to Humboldt County because this is a nice place to live in an age of climate change.
It's cold and wet.
It's cold and wet. Yeah, absolutely.
And the air quality here is still mostly good. I mean, a lot of these people have been fleeing the smoke week after week after week of smoke from wildfires and houses burning and...
Yeah, any of the valleys. So any valley is usually going to have a thermal inversion trapping all the smoke down in the valley floor. And those people have to go through months of polluted air like that. Whereas on the coast, we have the northwesterly wind that clears it out here most of the time.
So, Jen, you brought up this international lawsuit that was filed. So it was Greta and I think 15 other students from across the planet that filed this lawsuit. They filed it against five countries, Germany, France, Brazil, Argentina, and Turkey, which they said had failed to uphold their obligations under international law, specifically the Convention of the Rights of the Child, which was a treaty that just about every country in the world signed in the 1990s, I believe, 1989. It is the most signed human rights treaty ever crafted, and it lays out the inalienable rights of children. And among these are the right to life, health, and peace. with a special stipulation for indigenous groups. So what do you all think? Are we going to litigate our way out of this? Is this any sort of a meaningful step, or is it symbolic at best?
It'll be interesting to see which attorneys step up to fight the children on this one.
Yeah.
And envy them.
Yeah.
The problem with international law is there's no international government to enforce the decisions of an international court. So it may well be a useful step to take in terms of, you know, drawing attention to the issues and raising to citizens around the world the disconnect between the things our governments claim and the things we're actually doing. But no, we can't litigate our way through this. We certainly can't do it by using an international court system that doesn't constrain national governments. That's just a problem we have at that level.
I remember going to law school and learning about international law, and it just is, it's like the fake law. It's the
law of diplomacy.
Yeah. You know,
there's consequences, sort of, yeah. But you can't put a country in jail and you can't put it on probation. You can take measures against it. But I want to talk about Greta Thunberg's particular perspective on the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this goes back to a conversation we were having a couple of weeks ago about our emotional relationship to climate and climate grief and how that really impairs our collective response to the problem. And, you know, what we're seeing here just in the last week or so of the right-wing reactions to Greta Thunberg is, here's a mentally ill girl who's being taken advantage of. And, of course, this is completely wrong. Greta has Asperger's. She's on the spectrum, as you say. It's a form of autism. But that's not a mental illness. It's a neurotypical difference. And, you know, people with Asperger's can be kind of difficult, but they seem to be really, really good at seeing through lies. They seem to have an inability to tolerate propaganda and falsehoods. And clearly she's capable of real emotion, but she has this sort of emotionless affect that I think a lot of people find kind of creepy. But that's Asperger's. And what I find most interesting of all here is that she describes her diagnosis as a kind of mutism, which is to say she only speaks when it's necessary to speak, which I think we should all reflect on a little bit about the amount of speaking she's been doing, you know, and how difficult that is for her just to speak at all, much less to speak in front of the UN General Assembly.
What's the local indigenous tribe say about it? They have a name for us.
I've been told that in the Hoopa language, white people translates to their mouths flap.
There you go.
I wouldn't call her style emotionless, though. I found it very emotionally compelling. If people haven't watched the full speech, it's only about 5 minutes long, but, you know, there were little clips on the news here and there, but the full speech is well worth watching. And, you know, I hope it inspires a lot of adults to remember how passionate we were when we were 16 years old, and whatever the issue may have been, you know. And then as you get older and supposedly wiser, you get more and more kind of jaded and boxed in by all the things that you know about the world. And I hope that she inspires a lot of people to really think about what we're going to have to do.
I thought there was a great interview with Greta on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Interview.
Yeah, that was really well done.
I thought that was excellent, and I thought her humanity shone through better in that interview than some things I've seen.
Well, tell us about it. I haven't seen this interview.
I would advocate anybody who hasn't seen it to check it out on YouTube. It's up. And it was Trevor being a little more serious than he usually is with his interviews. He was, I think, being respectful. But he did joke around with her, and she was able to roll with it. I thought it was pretty cool. He likened her trip across the Atlantic to the Viking explorers. She got a kick out of that.
Well, in her perspective, and in the fact that she refused to fly and sailed across the ocean to come to the United Nations really puts, you know, a real twist on the Conference of the Parties and how there are so many people flying from all over the globe to go, you know, maybe take a 12th tier seat in the adjacent building to where the actual negotiations are happening and rub elbows with all these important people from around the world. And, you know, how many years this has been going on for, with pretty dismal results.
For me, the line that really stuck with me after the Trevor Noah interview was Trevor asked Greta Thunberg, what can we do as individuals? You know, raising this whole question of whether it's collective action or individual action or both. And what Greta said was, what we should do as individuals is to use the power of democracy to make our voices heard and to make sure that the people in power cannot continue to ignore this. And that's really what it comes down to is, you know, it's not about our consumer choices. It's not about our messages of protest. It's our actions as citizens holding our government accountable. And there's some stuff happening in Washington, D.C. right now that is kind of congruent with that larger theme. You know, we need to hold our leaders accountable. And it's really pretty urgent that we do so, because if we don't, then we can't steer this boat straight.
Is that a veiled reference to the impeachment inquiry that which might begin?
Not very veiled.
Very veiled. Yeah.
I pay a lot more attention on the local level as far as what government agencies are doing or not doing. And, you know, we know that we have a sea level rise problem, that whether we can change the emissions, the rates of emissions or not, sea level rise is going to continue to rise for 50 years. And we live right on the coast, and we know we're going to have to plan for this, and it's going to be difficult. You know, in every community across the United States, there are, generally speaking, local government officials and staff who make decisions for the short-term gains because who's talking in their ear the loudest is the property owners, the developers, and the realtors who want the status quo to continue. And it's really difficult for those elected officials to stand up to those forces unless they have a lot of support, whether it's in San Diego, where they're, you know, approving hundreds and hundreds of new homes and subdivisions in high fire risk areas with one way out and one way in,
yeah,
or whether it's, you know, Humboldt County continuing to approve development in flood zones, despite what we know. You know, we can't keep planning development based on the history of flooding, because the history is not an accurate guide to the future anymore.
Well, and we can't let markets decide, because that's the way we've always done it. And it's failing. It's not working. And what that sets up is for more social injustice, because the people that are going to take it on the chin are the poorest of us, or don't have the ability to just pack up and sell their place and move somewhere else. They're going to be the ones stuck in the flood zone, because that's the only place they're going to be able to afford to buy or rent, is those places. And if this really takes a government solution to this, it's not something individuals can do. They need to get their representatives to take action. And I advocate personally retreat. And we need to start doing it in an organized fashion now in order to be successful, so that we don't put all the onus on the poorest of us.
So locally, when Jen's talking about what we can do, we should know more in a short time. The county is working on its climate action plan, which is, you know, probably 10 years too late, but at least we're getting it done now. The climate action plan should be able to create a list, kind of a to-do list, for what we need to do as a community to minimize our own contributions to this problem, which is part of the discussion we need to have. What can we do to lower our greenhouse gas emissions, as well as what can we do to minimize impacts to folks and to mitigate those impacts? So it's something that the county, I think, is hoping to have done in early 2020. God, is it really going to be 2020 next year? And so I'm looking forward to that. But something else that is terrifying at the same time is the pushback that we're going to inevitably get when the climate action plan comes out. Already, I think that we're seeing moves at the Board of Supervisors to deaden the impact of this climate action plan. So recently, Supervisor Rex Bone proposed a climate advisory committee. And if any other member of the Board of Supervisors would have proposed this, I would have thought, you know, fantastic, our board is actually taking this seriously, you know? But it's Rex. Rex doesn't care about climate change. He appoints people to boards that don't care about climate change. So what is his ultimate purpose? And, you know, Mike Wilson, Supervisor Wilson, God bless him, raised that point before the Board of Supervisors, and all of his colleagues yelled at him because he was being too rude. You know, why are we appointing climate deniers to the Planning Commission? And they said, oh, climate denier, that's a dirty word. Why would you impugn these good people who are volunteering their time? And I think that this is something that we need to be watchful of, which is the inevitable pushback. And I think that the pushback is going to come through things like this, through actions that may seem well-intended, but are really going to just be a disguise for inaction, for throwing process at it. We can paralyze any sort of action through additional analysis, paralysis by analysis.
Beware of the subcommittee.
And this raises an interesting point that I wanted to talk about as well, which was we got an email a week or so ago, the three of us did, sorry, Scott, from a city council member in a local town. I guess I won't out them. And the person asked, you know, people are approaching me and they want to have, you know, a climate emergency resolution passed by our board. But like, what is this actually going to do? Is there any sort of purpose in passing these things? And I thought that there were some good responses from folks here. So Jen, what was your idea? Or why do you think a climate emergency resolution could be good? And what are the potential pitfalls in some sort of actions like that?
Well, sometimes local governments will declare sweeping resolutions that don't really have much action embedded in them. You know, maybe it's some broad proclamation on federal policy or something like that. Sometimes they do have very meaningful results. But, you know, you pointed out that oftentimes they can lead to positions in a small incremental way that actually do make changes. And so
Arcata has a long history of doing just that.
So there was a New York Magazine, you know, the Jonathan Franzen thing about how, you know, there's two views of all of this. One is we're all just wasting our time on these, like, biodiversity campaigns or, you know, trying to protect the bay water quality because the climate is changing and it's, you know, this huge problem and why aren't we all focused on the climate emergency? But then there's the other view, which is the climate emergency or the climate crisis is going to exacerbate all of those things and we just need to work harder on those issues, you know, like from the baykeeper perspective. There is a lot of contaminated old mill sites, old industrial sites around the bay that are very low-lying and they were built on wetland fill. And as the sea rises, they're going to get, you know, more and more flooded or the groundwater is going to be more connected to the bay. And so we need more than ever to be focusing on those local issues that are going to be exacerbated by the changing climate. And, you know, there's a lot written about that. And
I think I saw one headline about that Jonathan Franzen article that said something like, we should stop letting rich white men write things or something like that because of the drivel that they come out. Like, Jonathan Franzen, no matter what, he's always going to produce a strong response when he says something. This is his second New Yorker article that has caused people to have a conniption. I mean, I'm sympathetic to some of his points. So he's, like I said, had two New Yorker articles. One was about 5 years ago, and he expressed concern that climate change was sucking the air out of other conservation work. And, you know, I know that that's true in our work at EPIC. It seems that we some conservationists have become singularly focused on climate change to the detriment of other issues. And if there is a potential conflict with other issues, you know, climate change is given whole and sole priority. And we've seen this a bit with this Terrigen wind farm.
Well, you know, honestly, Tom, I've seen this over the decades in the environmental movement. You have to sometimes step back and look at what your motivation is as an environmental activist. Are you an ecologist or not? I come at it from ecology. And to me, you can't divorce any of these things. They're all part of one big thing. And if you just say, oh, well, I'm only interested in the marble murrelet being hit by propeller blades, I'm not interested in climate change or, you know, anything like that, that to me, that's a false way to, it's flawed. It's not, you have to look at the whole picture. All of these things make up the ecosystem. You can't have one part fail, because then it causes a catastrophic failure that goes all the way through the whole ecosystem. So we have to look at it as all one big picture, in my opinion. And I think that, so some people are brought to the environmental movement for a particular thing. That's their bell whistle thing, that they're attracted to it. But I'm attracted to it for the whole picture, the whole ecosystem.
But the risk is the people who are only attracted for the thing, for the climate change, and then we can potentially lose, right? If you don't care about the Anthropocene and the loss of global biodiversity, you just care about climate change, you could be in support of some actions that are harmful and detrimental to one environmental concern at the expense of climate change or of the climate. So I think that Jonathan Franzen, as much as I hate his novels and I think he's a terrible writer, I think that he is right there. He has this remarkable ability too in his novels, just to get into some literary critique, to create characters who are almost human but are not actually human. Like they are kind of creepy resemblances, uncanny valley sort of things. But I think that he has a point, and that we, one of the risks to the environment right now is environmentalism, this modern strain of environmentalism. And I'm not saying that focus on climate is bad. I think we should absolutely focus on climate change, but let's not forget about traditional conservation work and the need to protect individual places as appropriate and individual species and clean water, right?
I've been talking about climate change for over 20 years, and it's never dulled my focus on any of the other issues. So, but I know it can be done, but I understand what you're talking about, Tom, and you're right. There is a pitfall there. You bring people into the movement that are one-issue people, and then when that issue... Well, of course, if we address that issue, I'll be amazed.
So the article is called, What If We Stop Pretending? To prepare for the climate apocalypse, we need to admit that we can't prevent it, is really what he's talking about. And, you know, I mean, I just have an issue with all the doom and gloom and never giving people thoughts on what can we do? What can you do? What should be done on a social level or on an individual level? But then, you know, some of that is kind of Pollyannish. Like, you know, there are things that you really can't do a whole lot about. And
you could keep your cat inside.
You could keep your cat inside or just not get a cat.
That'll help a little bit.
You know, my cat died over Christmas that I had adopted after he was abandoned by some people in Eureka, and I'm just not going to get another cat. They just kill too many birds.
Unless they live indoors, like my cat never goes outside, never kills any birds.
Yeah, that's right. I couldn't handle that, but I'm a dog person. It's no secret. Everybody knows. But, you know, there's lots of things that need to change, and, you know, but should we just accept that some things, you know, are going to be too difficult to change and stop fighting? I think you brought up, was it 2 weeks ago, you know, that you just can't. I mean, there are people like us who just can't stop doing what we think we can do. And are we maybe tilting at windmills sometimes, literally and figuratively? Yeah.
Are we maybe not neurotypical? Maybe, you know.
Yeah, but if we're going to go down, I'd rather go down swinging than just sit there going, oh, well, okay, I give up.
Well, and again, in the long, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years of human evolution as a species, we have mostly benefited from being people who, you know, sort of persevere and get through stuff. But at times we face real challenges, and, you know, in emergencies, it's often the case that the things we've always done don't work out so well. And, you know, you kind of need to pay attention to the outliers. And I think what we're doing right now and what Greta Thunberg is doing right now is being an outlier. And, you know, if people won't listen to us, we just got to be a little more direct. I guess is my take on that, you know, because we really do face real emergencies. And, you know, there is, you said, you know, can we keep going? Well, no, we can't. We know we can't. We can't keep going on this energy system. We can't keep going on this social system. We've got to change a lot of stuff. So we might as well sort of face up to it and do it. That's what I hear the Green New Deal doing, is saying, okay, we got to make big changes. Let's face it.
So does anyone think that there's a risk? I see us as an environmental movement kind of deifying Greta and this kind of singular hero,
messianic force. I absolutely reject the deify.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think she's been a singularly effective spokesperson, but, you know, Malala Yousaf was not the only spokesperson for women's education, you know, and Greta Thunberg is not the only teenager to have crusaded on this issue. You know, those of us who have been following it are well aware that there are, you know, a dozen U.S. kids who've been bringing a public trust climate suit for the last, you know, 5 years now.
I saw some other kids interviewed on MSNBC the other night. One was from India,
yeah,
who had brought suit against her country. And another one was an indigenous boy from Alaska. And he had a little bit of trouble putting into words what he was experiencing, but it was very moving how he described that their lifestyle involves getting on snowmobiles and hunting, and they can't do that now because there's no ice.
Right. And I follow somebody from, you know, a school striker from Uganda who's a young boy who just saw what Greta was doing and said, okay, we got to do this. One of the most inspiring marches I saw on last Friday was in Papua New Guinea.
Right. I saw that.
I want to mention, too, the Karuk tribe just came out with a climate adaptation plan that is pretty forward-thinking. And, you know, the Karuk tribe is not beholden to the same capitalist system that our dominant society is. So they're, right, you know, they're also speaking to making America great again in a really different sense, which is going back to before white people were here and reinstating some of their traditions around fire and managing the land on a broader scale. And so we'll post that link in the post on the Lost Coast Outpost, because it's really worth looking at and thinking about, you know, what the creative solutions are when you're not constrained by the capitalist system that we're constrained by. What about the walruses?
Yeah, Scott, tell us about walruses.
It was kind of a joke, but I mean, y'all know that you never mess with a moose, right?
Right.
I mean, they're big deer, but the bottom line is,
They're big.
They're very big, and they're very, very cranky. And, you know, the equivalent in Africa is a Cape buffalo. You know, you just don't mess with them because they are going to come after you, and they will stomp whatever vehicle you're in. You know, I don't care if it's an F-350. Okay, so the reason I raised the moose is because walrus are, in fact, the moose of the Arctic Ocean. You do not mess with walrus. They're enormous. They're cranky. And, oh, yeah, they have, like, 4-foot swords on the front of their face. So apparently what happened here was Russian scientific expedition in the Arctic had sent a boat out to land on a beach. And they got too close to a mother walrus's, I don't know what you call a baby walrus.
Baby walrus.
It's only like the size of a Volkswagen bus, you know. Okay, Beetle. You know, Mama's the size of a bus. Anyway, Mom got cranky. And, you know, the people in the boat managed to make to shore. And then later they sent another boat and managed to rescue them. But the boat is underneath the ocean now because Mama Walrus got mad and sunk the boat.
Well, this is
us?
Yeah, and herself. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
This is the start of the animal uprising.
Well,
I think that this arming animals is the way that we can most effectively fight back against climate change.
Yeah, as the old T-shirt said, I support your right to arm bears.
Yeah.
But realistically, I think, you know, anybody who's read Moby Dick knows that animals can and do fight back, but, you know, technology is too much for them to contend with usually. So,
well, on that silly note, this has been the Eco News Report.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Fred, as always, for engineering. If there's a topic you want discussed on a future show, email me at tom@wildcalifornia.org. Catch us next week at this time and channel for more Eco News. Thanks, everybody.